This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 6th of July 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're continuing our series of Monocle guides to the summer by providing you with a holiday reading list. On the show I'll be shooting the breeze with Arifa Akbar, literary editor of The Independent, and John Mitchinson, founder of Unbound Publishers, who have the lowdown on which fiction and non-books you should be packing in your suitcase over the coming months. Plus we'll have some top tips for some of the best magazines on offer, including our brand new summer publication, The Escapist. Our editor, Andrew Tuck, joins us in the studio later on to leaf through the mag, which hits newsstands very soon. Grab your beach towel, plug in your summer playlist, or order an Aperol Spritz as we head poolside on this week's edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. So I'm in the studio, as promised, with Arifa Akbar, literary editor of The Independent, and John Mitchinson, founder of Unbound Publishers. Welcome both to the programme.
Hi.
We kind of set it up. We sort of said it was going to be a beach towels, and I mean, that's what happens when papers, not like the August Independent, perhaps, Arifa, but they put together these reading lists, and there has to be like a beach towel in there somewhere.
There has to be a recliner.
That is not to belittle either the fiction or non-fiction that we'll be talking about today. I just want to point that out to our listeners who might be sitting at the top of a tower block somewhere and can't see the sea and won't see it for the summer months, right? We shouldn't judge like that.
You can still challenge the brain cells on a recliner, you know. Your brain doesn't turn to mush. It doesn't melt. It's not a lolly.
Am I allowed to say I do all my best thinking on my back, or is that not?
Okay. I think that's entirely acceptable.
Thank you, John.
I think it's exactly right. I think you're more capable of absorbing complex information when you're lying in the sun than when you're trying to sort of run a busy life. I think holidays are the best time to read challenging stuff.
Into which are we going to fly first? I think Go Set a Watchman, none more anticipated, I suppose, new book from Harper Lee.
The event publication of the year, if not the last 65 years, because that's the last time.
Put that on the jacket.
That's what they should have put on it. That's the last time Harper Lee actually wrote a book, in 1960. That was her debut, To Kill a Mockingbird, still one of the best read, biggest bought books ever.
Most studied.
It's 64 million copies or something insane, isn't it, that it's sold over the years. And I remember reading it and being completely blown away by it.
I reread it 2 weeks ago and I was blown away by it.
Now, that's the great thing as well, when something is such a sort of set text, literally and metaphorically.
And you avoid it.
You avoid it
like the plague. But when you actually sit down and read it, you think, oh yes, this is why it's endured for 65 years. Listen, I'm interested to see what happens with Go Set a Watchman. I think it'll be massive, not least because of the controversy it's already ignited and will ignite on the 14th of July. It's a story, let me get this right. It was actually written before. Harper Lee wrote it before she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. Her agent, editor, whatever, said, take out the adult bits and just make this a children's story. You know, a story rather about children. So then we got To Kill a Mockingbird in 1960.
This is editors and publisher choice we've got here.
In some ways, but this is the story 20 years after. So the children, Jem, the brother, and Scout, the central sort of sister, they've grown up now. Scout's come back to Alabama to visit Macomb, you know, to visit Atticus. Atticus, the lawyer, Gregory Peck, as we know him. and she's come back and there's a civil rights, she's embroiled in the civil rights movement. But you know, a lot of people have questioned whether Harper Lee wanted this. She's 79. Did she choose to publish it? Was she pushed? Her sister died. And then, you know, Harper Lee has famously once said she'd never published another novel after To Kill a Mockingbird.
And you wonder also how recently that book, To Go Set a Watchman, might have been edited. And I wonder whether books like this get edited with sympathy, empathy, or perhaps an admirable lack of care to the current circumstances in which we live.
It's interesting you mention editing, because this is a book that has not been edited at all. So this is really, this could be, and this is what the controversy is around.
A slim 2,100 pages.
Yes, but it could be appalling for the lack of edit, the fact that Harper Lee hasn't gone back and refined it. But we all get a massive hullabaloo and it will be sensational. So it's going to sell a lot of copies.
We're going to have to move on. We're going next to Man on Fire, the new novel from Stephen Kelman. Fill us in, Arifa, on the plot of this, because this sounds like a really good idea, and it sounds almost basically like something that is analogous to trying to write a novel oneself, going on a weird trip and trying to succeed or fail, but spectacularly, and write about it, I suppose.
It's a wacky and quite courageous thing to do,
yeah.
Particularly, you know, his debut novel, which I'll talk about in a minute, did really well. Basically, it's about an Englishman who's a bit of a... He's not so much a loser, but, you know, life has not taken the shape that he would have
Life's
liked.
Not allowed him to win.
Okay. He's definitely not winning yet. His marriage is sort of faltering a bit. His life doesn't have the verve that he wants it to have. So he takes himself off to Mumbai and he attaches himself. He becomes an assistant to this man who's risen from poverty into a strange celebrity. He is a performer. He does sort of masochistic acts, displaying sort of endurance and courage. So the big challenge of this novel is that he's going to have 50 cricket bats broken on his body, and it's going to be a public performance. And you can sort of imagine this happening on the streets of Mumbai. It's a sort of circus come human endeavour that people find eternally fascinating. I think this is the Indian man is sort of a metaphor on how to conquer pain, and maybe this is why this young Englishman called John Locke has left his rather dreary life. And these two men connect. And what happens next, I don't know, because it's one of the books that's coming out in August. I haven't read it. I'm looking forward to reading it. I read his debut, Pigeon English, and it was heavily fought over, wasn't it?
At
auction.
Right.
Publishers went bonkers. They all wanted it. It then got onto the Booker shortlist. I'm quite excited to see what he does with Man on Fire.
That sounds like an amazing thing. It sounds like something that crackles with ideas.
Yes.
And also that idea of someone that is not from somewhere forming, you know, hopefully a literary expression of a city about which presumably he visited and now knows well enough to tell us about it in prose.
It really goes against this idea, and I think Harper Lee famously said it, that an author should write about what he or she knows truthfully. And I think nowadays we think it's not as simple as that, that, you know, I think someone like Stephen Kelman, I hope, shows us that you can write truthfully about worlds that are very foreign to your own.
The Kindness of Enemies, that's a good title. It's the third and last bit of fiction. Great. We've got the time to whiz through. This is a new novel by Leila Abu Leila. Talk us through this one.
Leila Abu Leila has written, this is her fourth novel, as you say, and she's Sudanese Egyptian.
I like the way you covered up for me there. This is the first novel. I don't know why I said first, as if I knew. You're absolutely right, Rob. It's her fourth novel.
You know why you said it? It's because Leila Abu Leila is this, I think, because I've read everything she's written, a brilliant writer that nobody really knows about. So I bet lots of people think this is some author's first book, and it's not. It's set in Scotland. Leila Abu Leila lived, you know, moved to Aberdeen for a few years and seems to have set more than one novel there. This is set in Scotland, and it revolves around this woman called Natasha, who's researching the life of a 19th century warrior. His name's Imam Shamil. He's defending the mountains of the Caucasus against the Russian invasion. That sounds quite dry, but actually, I think it's much more interesting than it sounds. It sweeps across that region, Tsarist Russia, back to contemporary Scotland, where Natasha is working. Natasha meets a child, and this child is connected to this warrior, and there's secrets there, and there's an epic love story, apparently. But it seems to have sort of everything we want in a recliner. You know, this other worlds idea, where you have more patience for another world.
Yeah.
This epic story, love, war, betrayal, redemption, all of that. So I think it's one of those sort of, let's lose ourselves in an entirely, you know, historical universe with grand themes. She's very good at tying people's personal stories to the bigger politics. You'll get all that history, the Caucasus, the revolution, Russia, but you'll get, I think, really powerful story of this Natasha, of this character, and the little boy.
And you've chosen something really interesting here in your last two choices, Man on Fire, Stephen Kelman, a man born in Luton, I think, who's writing about Mumbai, and the Sudanese Egyptian novelist who's writing about Aberdeen via way of the Caucasus in sort of medieval times as well.
It's
a fantastic work of imagination, and that's presumably what we're in this room talking about. We hope. Well, you know,
And two books that immediately I want to go out and and buy.
It's fantastic stuff. Yeah. Arifa Akbar, thank you so much for your choices. We're going to put a bookmark in this conversation for a moment to hear from David Pleasant, producer of Monocle's weekly show on the publishing industry, The Stack. He's picked out his favourite magazines, best enjoyed lying horizontally as we do our best thinking, as previously discussed on The Sun Lounger.
My first magazine pick that I would take on holiday with me is Limes, slightly unusual magazine. It's the Italian magazine of geopolitics. Very geeky, very focused on foreign affairs, but somehow it's a little bit strange, and it opens up itself to people that perhaps wouldn't dabble in this field. It's full of facts, full of maps. Each issue is devoted to one topic. So the latest issue is Russia at war. You wouldn't think it's the kind of thing that you'd want to take on holiday, but the sheer detail and the level of research that goes into every issue makes it really worthwhile. And I always think that when you are on holiday and when you do have a magazine, you want something that's really going to take up a lot of time. You know, you want density, and Limes sure has that. Lots of really good infographics, really informative, good magazine if you want to get your teeth into geopolitics. That's Limes from Italy. My next choice is an architecture title, but it's an architecture title with a difference. It's called Pinup Magazine, that comes from New York. Its byline is actually a magazine for architectural entertainment, and it really does what it says on the tin. It's a really light-hearted, colourful, playful look at architecture. It's not serious like a lot of architectural critique can be. I'm amazed how they always manage to come up with their stories. Completely unpredictable. Whatever's in Pinup issue will inevitably be the trend and what everyone's talking about 6 months later. The current issue is African architecture. Amazingly colourful issue. There's an interview with David Ajaye, the London-based architect, who seems to really be reviving the landscape of modern architecture. There's also a 48-page photographic journey through Africa by a photographer, Iwan Ban, which is just extraordinary, interspersed with kind of collage, really interesting art direction. Pinup is also quite dense. It's not just about the visuals. It's not just pretty pictures. There's some essays in there that, you know, will keep me busy poolside. My last choice for holiday reading is a slightly unusual one, given that this magazine is geared towards women, and it's called Riposte. It's now in its fourth issue. It's just a wonderful collection of essays, interviews with mainly women, as you might imagine. The current issue has some really good features that, you know, are meaty, they have substance, keep me entertained. One really good feature of the current issue that I think it makes for great holiday reading is an insert that the magazine has called The Anonymous Sex Journal. Riposte have decided to do a collaboration with The Anonymous Sex Journal. They've published it in the magazine. So there's this pull-out, wonderfully illustrated series of animations, pretty graphically depicting some of the stories in The Anonymous Sex Journal. So all in all, Riposte is a fascinating collection of stories and editorial that I think is not just to be enjoyed by women.
Thanks, David. After the break, John Mitchinson will be giving us his non-fiction reading tips. Stick around.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. I'm in the studio with Arifa Akbar, literary editor of The Independent, and John Mitchinson, founder of Unbound Publishers. We've had our top fiction picks for the summer, but now we're going to move on to the non-fiction section of the bookshop. John, what has been tickling your beard?
It's not a new book, but the book I'm definitely going to pack into my satchel when I leave is going to be Sapiens, which is a book by Yuval. It's a huge 450-page history, a brief history of humankind. So not at all ambitious, just an attempt merely to explain the last 100,000 years of human history. I haven't read it, but what I've picked up about the book and what people have told me about it is that it's fantastically ambitious, and that the core idea of it is that we are a species that has changed the planet more than any other. He starts from the very basic principle of how have we managed to do this? We're not the strongest animal, we're not the fastest, but we do seem to have this extraordinary ability to work together. So human beings, you know, small family groups of human beings have learnt to work with other small family groups of human beings to create what is, I guess, essentially civilization.
It doesn't waste much time on the biology of it, but it talks about habit and manners and how they have and haven't changed over the years, and money.
And that's what's, money. The idea is that we invent all this stuff. We invent ideas, like we invent communism, we invent capitalism, we invent money. Money in the end is an idea, and we make these things real by the, you know, they become self-fulfilling prophecies. So that interests me. Mm. The other little bit of kind of stuff that amazed me about this book is this was the number one best-selling book at the Hay Festival of all the books that were. So that was kind of a curious thing. Yeah. I'm interested that we as a species are interested in ourselves and interested in what makes us tick. And I think everybody's always looking for explanations, aren't they? Fairly crappy sort of evolutionary biological explanations, like, you know, well, he can't, you know, he looks at the fridge and he can't find the butter because he's a hunter-gatherer and his eyes are sort of, you know, still tuned to the savannah, whereas I'm a woman and I'm used to doing it. I mean, there's a lot of that nonsense, and I think there will probably be a fair amount of tendentious nonsense in this book, but I like a bit of tendentious nonsense.
It just proves that you have to kill your own butter and then and you feel attached to it from an earlier age. I see that in front of you, you have picked up Skyfarer, Mark Van Honecker's book. He's an interesting man.
Really interesting. He's a commercial pilot, but he's also, as it turns out, an astonishing writer.
Yeah.
But what he does is, you know that amazing thing? I thought this would be the perfect book to read on a plane. When you're sitting there, looking through your ice-fringed window out onto the world below.
And then you read the chapter which says, of course we spend most of the time asleep up in the cockpit.
Well, I've got a really good friend who's a pilot. One, I thought he'd love this book. But I talked to him about this, the fact that most of the job now is basically just pushing a few buttons. And in fact, planes land so accurately, they have to change the program to stop the tires digging runnels into the concrete. That's how most landings, I mean, who knew this? I'm always assume there's a guy up the front pulling backwards, you know, for all it's worth, but no. But he's brilliant about what it feels like, the extraordinariness, which has become, we've almost become denatured to it. We get into that flight. We don't really think that we're in a, you know, we're in essentially in a tin can at 30,000 feet flying at 600 miles an hour. It is a miraculous thing that we do.
And Mark Van Honecker, I've read this book and it's a fantastic book.
Oh, great.
He demystifies and mystifies in equal measure. And that's the great success of this book, I think. Yeah. He's open to the magic of travel and of air travel, but also he makes his actual job sound very ordinary, which is quite selfless of him and kind of, it's kind of big-hearted of him.
Well, I'm a great, for my non-fiction, I like to read books by people, not exactly experts, but people who've done stuff. There are too many books by, you know, broadly columnists writing about things. Mm. I love it when you've got somebody who has spent a lifetime thinking and reflecting, as he has done, because he's a pilot.
However much people say they're immune to the terror, but also the thrill of flying, I think they're lying. I think you feel exhilarated and terrified at the same time, whichever flight you're on. Which is why I'd want to read this.
I get tremendously sentimental when I'm on. I start to write letters to my wife and things when I'm on a long haul flight. Yeah. I don't, there's something weird about. Maybe it's just that the atmosphere is very thin.
It's the thing you probably have a couple of little tots of wine, and then you're leaving someone that you love, or you're going to someone you love. I once cried during Get me to the Greek starring Russell Brand on a plane, which tells you
that's so true. You're weirdly emotionally open, aren't you?
I think it's because you were reminded of your mortality.
Well, maybe.
Must have been.
I will never get to the Greek. Boo-hoo. John, what's your next book?
My third book. Now, staying with the expert theme and thinking about things that are universal, this is a totally not universal book, or maybe it's more universal than I think, but it's a book, beautiful book. It's called In Pursuit of Butterflies, A 50-Year Affair. And Matthew Coates is one of the I mean, he's one of the UK's great entomologists. He studies Lepidoptera. That's his butterflies. I think there are 53 species of butterflies that are in Britain. I love butterflies. I love the natural world. I live in a very beautiful place that there are summer, you know, when butterflies start to arrive, there's something incredibly romantic. And just the colour of them and the madness of them. They can only survive if the temperature is at a certain level. And they have this incredibly complicated pheromonal way of kind of behaving. So I think it's an interesting subject. It's not for everybody, but the thing that you get here is somebody who knows more about butterflies than anybody else, who spent his life thinking about them. And again, as far as I can see, writes really very, very funny stories about trying to find the most extreme and rare species.
Do you also think that, you know, the more urban we get, the more removed from nature, that, you know, when these books sort of remind us of the strong emotional connections that these things can give us. So yeah. H is for Hawk was, you know, it combined hawks, heraldry, with loss, grief, you know, and I think this butterfly book does something similar. It sort of, it talks about our emotional connection with this thing.
And you're right, because I think we have always used nature as a thing that we project onto and metaphors. It's a brilliant, I was thinking of really lovely butterfly quotes. It's a great thing that the great American novelist whose name Nathaniel Hawthorne. Yeah. He said that happiness like a butterfly, you know, you chase it, you'll never be able to catch it, but if you sit still, it might just land on the back of your hand. Mm. And we've all had that extraordinary experience of a butterfly landing on us and looking at just the sheer implausible beauty of these creatures. And I think there is something, I mean, I think you're right. I think losing that is something that that is a fear. That's quite a primal fear, that we will lose our connection with nature. Nature is important.
Mm. We've gone full circle in John Richardson's tour. We started off with sapiens, we got on a plane, and we ended up with a delicate butterfly landing on the back of our hand. Thank you very much indeed, John. I've got one little last brief zinger for you. I wonder if, Arifa, maybe you can choose first, what you can remember as being your favourite book you've ever read on holiday?
The ultimate summer read, Death in Venice, Thomas Mann's book.
Good. Yeah.
Stultifyingly hot, stuffy summer in Venice. An elderly man, he's got writer's block, and he sees this young boy, 14-year-old boy, Tadzio, and they don't even talk. They never actually talk in this novel. And he becomes interested at first, quite inspired, and then obsessed. But what is so extraordinary about it is that it just becomes this book about, it's a human story about the place that beauty takes in the writer's life, but also in our lives. What beauty, you know, because this boy is a vision of beauty for this older writer. And, you know, how we come to terms with loneliness and ourselves as we age. And
it's the essence of sort of unrequitedness, isn't it?
And the essence of unrequitedness. So it's got that passion, that sort of love that never will be, or passion that never will be. It's got a bit of everything, and it's got a lot of sun.
John?
The one that comes back to me, it's an odd choice, but it was a book called Roads to Santiago by Cees Notenboom, the Dutch writer. And I remember it because I was in Spain, and the first half of the holiday was a kind of, you know, we were just lying around reading and, you know, swimming and eating fish, which is all perfectly good. But the book was about his travels through Spain and through the most extraordinary architectural tour of that amazing Mozarabic architecture and Visigothic architecture. And it sounds incredibly dry, but he's an amazing writer. And what I remember happening was I began to notice things around me. In fact, the second half of the holiday, I started to go off and we started to follow some of his itineraries to see if we could find. And I suppose that's the thing. It wasn't a book I had any expectations. I bought it because it had been recommended by a friend that it was a good book of Spanish travel. You know, it's nice to read books about the places that you're going. But I actually became kind of mildly obsessed by the whole thing. And it's funny, when you say a book that you remember really enjoying, that book, not only did I remember it, it kind of changed my holiday, certainly the second half of it. So as far as I know, I think it's still out there, still in print.
Perfect. Well, beautifully told, both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Arifa Akbar, literary editor of The Independent, and John Mitchinson, founder of Unbound Publishers. Thank you very much for your time. I don't think there's enough months in the summer, or certainly hours on a recliner to get our teeth into the books that you both recommended. Now, we can't let you go without telling you about the newest addition to the Monocle newsstand, The Escapist. Is our summer publication, and our editor Andrew Tuck is right here in the studio to talk about it.
Well, we both did kind of escape. You went to Chiang Mai,
I got to go to
Sapporo in the north of Japan on the island of Hokkaido. So yeah, we both got good trips out of it.
We did get good trips out of it, and I think important also to go to two places we hadn't been to before. You've been to Japan, but not to Hokkaido.
Yeah, and that's the whole nature of the escapist. Yeah. What we realised was that lots of our readers, actually they've now been to Japan or they've now been to Thailand, but there's that kind of first city phenomenon where you've been to Bangkok or maybe you've been to one of the beaches, but how do we get people to go a little bit further beyond the horizon? So, you know, for me, I've been to Japan, luckily, lots of times, but I'd never thought about really going up to Hokkaido. I'd seen it on the map. I thought I must go one day, but, you know, I'd been to Kyoto instead, like everybody else. But this was a chance to go elsewhere. And that's the whole point of this magazine. We're trying to show people 10 places around the world. There are 10 big city reports, and getting them to go to places which perhaps they know a little bit about, they're intrigued by. This is that final kick up the backside to make you go there.
Tristan McAllister, who's our transport editor, he got sent to Bangor, which is an interesting place to mention as well, which is the place where essentially if you're a naughty boy on a transatlantic flight, it's the first landfall or one of the first landfalls where you can be basically, a plane can be landed and you can be remanded into custody, right? That's kind of one of the reasons why they put that town on the map.
And that's why the FBI have a big outpost there. They're waiting for suspects to come across the Atlantic, because it also, if there's a potential terrorist attack, that's where a plane would try and come in and land. But an interesting town. It's a town that's kind of revived itself despite the fall off in traffic to the airport. It's invested in beer, in craft. It's gone back to all sorts of things. And actually a really intriguing little town. We sent Thomas Lewis, who's in our Toronto bureau. He went up to Anchorage. What we tried to do is mix and match places. So while I got to go to Japan, the bureau chief in Japan, Fiona Wilson, went to Australia. I think we're also trying to give a little bit of a different perspective. When you live in a country, when it's in front of you all the time, yes, you have an in-depth knowledge, but sometimes it's good to be the outsider, to be surprised about things, which I think you didn't know Thailand, you didn't know Chiang Mai, and your piece is one of the best pieces I think we've published for a long time, and a really wonderful, evocative piece. And perhaps because you went there fresh.
You need to not know, yeah. In fact, we've just been talking in this book-centric show, actually, about the idea of being a journalist or being a novelist and putting yourself in a place you don't know in order to have a very real reaction to it.
As always, we encouraged our writers, yes, of course, to go and knock on City Hall, but we also encouraged them to have a late night and a bit of a drink and to hang out with people.
Well,
and I think you took that part of the commission quite seriously, I hear.
I think it appears, warts and all are in the story.
But there's some steam and sex in the issue as well. It's like, what's great is that we went to the beach clubs of Beirut. Now, just as we've seen some terrible events in Tunisia, you think, God, that country will never resuscitate its tourism industry. Here's a country that was in civil war for over a decade, where everywhere still has that kind of like bombed out kind of air about it. But the beach clubs carried on all through the Civil War. They're still there. They're still amazing places to go to.
And it's got essays. It's got various different bits and bobs in it. Beautiful photography as ever. Look out for Sapporo.
That's one of the first thing I learned. It's not Sapporo, it's Sapporo. Everyone's, I even learned how to say it properly. It was only settled by the Japanese in the 1860s. And it happened at a period which we now know as the Meiji Restoration, which is just as Japan is changing. So they decided, okay, we need to colonize this. The shoguns had just lost their power. So they had all these samurai with no jobs to do. So they literally sent them up there as farmers. So what's amazing is it has none of that kind of depth of history of Kyoto. It looks modern. And in fact, because it was just at the point when Japan was opening up, they went to America and they said, we need your help kind of devising what the farms should look like. So oddly, when you go out to the farms, they look like Massachusetts. There's a really wonderful mix of all sorts of things going on there.
It's perfect. If only the Bee Gees had written a song about Sapporo, it would be just as good as Massachusetts. Andrew Tuck, thank you very much indeed. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. My producer was the complete and unabridged Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week when we'll be reviewing this summer's hottest art shows. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound. Thank you very much for tuning in.